Lesson 19, just to go through what I usually do here. Remember that we're here in the midst of California. You can see there's no cars, so we may need to go outside and look, make sure that they're still there. Anyway, and as we zoom out and go across the world, of course, we're just about halfway across the world to go to the Bible lands. And so this tiny little country then has been such an influence on us, as I've said many times. And of course, we're now, of course, at this time focusing more on this area than on the broader spectrum of areas now. So let me take the sidebar off so we can just see things here. And so we want to understand that what we're looking at from the book of Joshua was that we're looking at crossing from this side of the Jordan, coming down off of this plateau, or perhaps they came up along the side of the plateau. But anyway, we're coming down off the plateau and crossing the Jordan River right about here and taking what city first? Jericho. And then they went up sort of into the mountains and finally took Ai. And then after that, which city did they take? Bethel, okay. And I forget which way. I think Bethel's fairly close to Ai. So anyway, so they're here in the land now. I think it's important to realize that, you remember when we were talking about Balaam and Balak? And when Balaam and Balak looked down at the children of Israel from the mountain or hillside or whatever that they were on, how did they describe them? I'm probably asking a little too specifically, but they described them as covering the land. They were like, I don't know whether they said they were like locusts or anyway, they were just, you know, more than the grains of sand on the seashore for people. Now, how many people do we suppose that they had about? Probably still a million or two at least. How many fighting people was it? Over 600,000 fighting men. So that's fighting men. So generally speaking, since they're between 20 and 60, is it? Something like nominally. You could essentially double that for the amount of women, and you could probably maybe even triple it perhaps for the number of children or even more. And then, of course, there are all the hangers-on and things that may have been around them. Who knows? But a lot of people. And the fact of the matter is that at over 600,000 fighting men, they probably had more fighting men than the entire population of the land of Canaan at that time. You'll remember that I spoke to you a number of weeks ago about a book written by James Michener called The Source, where he went through an archaeological dig and went through the layers and started sort of at the bottom in the time of the prehistorical time before the Canaanites, and then came up to the Canaanite era. And he talked about, and I don't know how much research he did on this. I assume that James Michener did his research. You know, when they talked about wars at those times, you know, it's this king with, you know, 50 people in his kingdom, and they would send out their army of two people, and then they'd get together with the next neighboring city that was the big city that had like 100 people in it, and they had an army of five, and they'd go out and they'd team up against this other city that had 75 people in it and had an army of seven because they were much neater, much stronger. And, you know, they'd have this huge battle, and it would determine the shape of the kingdoms in that area at that time. So, you know, when we think about battles in this time, we're talking about, I mean, when there's feet on the ground, as they say, we're talking about tens and hundreds of thousands of people that are involved in a battle. And that wasn't the case at that time. So these people invading with well over 600,000 fighting men had to be extremely intimidating to the people that were here in the land of Canaan. We read throughout the book of Joshua last time about their entry into the land. And how did that go at the beginning? Their mission was to do what? Go in and displace the tribes that were there, right? How did that go? It went well. Chris, you got to... All right. It went well. You'll remember that they came in... Whoops, that's not a map. They came in across the river and took Jericho and took Ai, took Bethel, and then they started expanding. And they took all this area here, right? And then where'd they take all this area down here, which was rather not highly populated anyway, because this is all what down here? It's the Negev Desert, right? So down here it's not so, you know, there's some mountainous stuff in there, and there, as you can see, there's some greenery. So they took all this area, and then what did they do? What was the third circle? Remember that one? Way up here, right? So then they came up here and right around in the Megiddo area and places like that. Now, we're, once again, just to reiterate something we've said before, how is Megiddo, as it were, famous today? Armageddon. So what does Armageddon mean? Besides what people say that it is, what does Armageddon literally mean? It's Har Megiddo, which means the mountain of Megiddo. So the city of Megiddo is here on the plain of Megiddo, of all places. And then up above it is the mountain of Megiddo. So Har Megiddo, Armageddon, just means the mountain of Armageddon, of Megiddo. And so when we get into the book of Revelation, we're talking about an area right here in the plain of Megiddo, or where everybody's supposed to get together and battle and everything like that. But, you know, I've read through that area of the book of Revelation several times, and I don't see a big pitched battle. I see that the armies, it says that the armies gather together, and then God's done. They're all vanquished and sent to their destruction. We don't see a pitched battle with swords and knives and, you know, pitchforks and things like that. We see that it says that, you know, all the armies will gather together, then poof, there's judgment upon them. So even, I think, the idea behind the fact that, well, you know, the United States and Great Britain and Canada and Japan and all these people are going to get together against all of the armies of the Middle East and this and that, and it doesn't cut any water as far as I'm concerned. It's when we look at the entire book of Revelation, what have people said that really it is when we look at it from beginning to end to us? It's essentially a play that God is showing us that has different acts in it, as it were. And it moves along relatively chronologically, and it shows in a figurative way things that are going on. Of course, people that take the early date, might have a different interpretation of that. So... But it's interesting to, I've got a series of recordings that Homer Haley did before he wrote his commentary on Revelation that was done over at San Bernardino, in which he taught the book of Revelation. And he was talking about a lot of these things and some interesting stuff for him to hear. If you want a copy of those, it'd be interesting to listen to. It's about 12, it's a dozen or 15, I think, lessons, because it looked like it went over a week, and I think maybe ended on a Sunday. I can't quite tell. There was a 4th of July in there, and I'm trying to figure out whether it was 76 or 77 or 78. So, be that as it may. In the book of Joshua, we see them coming in and quickly taking this area and this area, and then moving up here and taking this area. Now, as we get into chapter 19 of our lesson book, we have then a quotation from Deuteronomy chapter 7. I noticed that all they did was put in Deuteronomy chapter 7, and given my due diligence, I did not look up the verses of those, but when the Lord thy God shall bring thee into the land, starts at verse 1 there, and then it ends with mighty destruction until they be destroyed. And so it's going down here. I don't think it goes to the end of the chapter, in right here to verse 23. mighty destruction. Yeah. And so the thing is that as we go through these verses here in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 7, there the authors are liking to point out down toward the end here in toward 23. It talks about in verse 22, it says, "And Jehovah thy God will cast out those nations before thee by little and little. Thou mayest not consume them at once, lest the beasts of the field increase upon thee." Now, you know, when we think about that, that makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, if you were to get rid of all the people in this, you know, generally speaking, it's a, you know, as far as people go, it's a large bit of land. And so the thing is, if you dispossess all the people and there's nobody there to take care of the crops and make sure that the harmful beasts are kept away from things, that, yes, certainly the coyotes or whatever they had around there will take over and things like that. So in the prophecy then in Deuteronomy, the seventh chapter, or maybe we could say this more a promise in Deuteronomy chapter 7, we see that God says that he'll cast out the nations, but he says that he'll do it little by little. So when they first went in, of course, they dispossessed the nations rather rapidly. Oops, wrong one. Rather rapidly in three general areas. But it was left up to them after this, after these three battles, to then take the rest of the thing little by little. And here's then where they got into trouble. It said that God would help them, but a lot of times they didn't ask for the help, or they didn't want the help, or as we see here in the first few lines of this chapter 19 on page 75, it says, "For the first times the Israelites had a homeland. Each tribe had its own territory. Each family within each tribe soon had its own plot of ground to farm or to use however it chose. This was a great day in their history." So they'd seen the miracles. They weren't the ones that murmured and rebelled. They'd served as courageous soldiers. And the author says that he believes that they intended to serve God all their lives, but humanity failed. So down in the paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4 above the bottom, it says, "Instead, time passed and very few additional Canaanites were destroyed. The various tribes felt distressed that there were still Canaanites within their borders. The tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim complained to Joshua about these within their territory. He told them to join forces and destroy the enemies, but they did not. The tribes of Judah and Simeon did join forces and made some raids. They were quite successful, but they stopped before attacking the most powerful cities. The typical Israelite family, no doubt, felt some distress over the remaining Canaanites, but the family itself was comfortable on its own farm. Months and then years passed with very few efforts to destroy the Canaanite neighbors with their idols. Gradually, Israelite families made friends with Canaanite families nearby. The Israelites first tolerated their neighbors' idolatrous worship of Baal and then began experimenting with the idols themselves." So we see that the people were told that God would help them, but the thing is that they needed to make some effort to begin with. They started off great, much like all of us do. We start off with a great amount of zeal, and we say, well, we've made it this far, so that's pretty good. So I'm going to sit back and rest upon my laurels for a while. Terry? Yeah, that's right. And so it was the opposite of what we see in Nehemiah, where they had a mind to work. The people initially had a mind to work, but then they sort of gave up on it. And I think this, the authors here sort of, you know, hit it fairly well when they say, but the people sort of got comfortable. But I think one of the things that God wanted to point out to them and that their leaders had told them was that God wanted them to do a lot of this themselves so that they realized that God wasn't just giving them houses and lands and crops and things like this just as a gift, but rather they needed to work for it. And the way they needed to work for it was to show that they believed and trusted in God, which they showed in the wilderness after their first 2 years by wanting to stone Joshua and Caleb when they came back with a report that said, God will help us. And they said, no, these other 10 guys are right. They're just giants in the land over there. We can't do this. And they refused to trust in God. And so when it came for them time to take the rest of the land, they failed to do so because of their waning trust and faith in God. So we see in what the authors say here in the first couple of paragraphs about fourth paragraph from the bottom, it talks about the tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim got together, the tribes of Judah and Simeon joined forces, and they had some successes. Joshua and Simeon had apparently some good successes, and but then after a while they just sort of became lackadaisical about it, and they decided, well, we can tolerate this. Now, that's not to say that at all times they let the tribes that were, or the peoples that were there, just have free reign. What did they do to the people when they came and they surrounded a city, but they didn't take it and destroyed it? They put them into forced labor. But as time went on, we see that there's more and more discussion about how they're sort of living with them, living side by side as though they were acceptable neighbors. When God told them, they needed to make some effort to get them out of there, and they did not do so. And so it wasn't God's fault that they didn't take all of the land. It was their faithlessness or their lack of faith that caused this, I don't know what you call it, punishment to fall upon them. We see that early on, that when Balaam and Balak were overlooking the people of Israel. We don't see anything right there in that story about Balaam and Balak that indicates that anything happened with the children of Israel at that time, other than Balaam blessed them at God's insistence. But we see later on in the New Testament that Balaam went on to induce the people to mingle with the native tribes and turn to idolatry. Such like as that. So it's interesting to note that though God made promises, they weren't promises that I'm just going to up and give you the land without any work on your part. Remember, I pointed out a number of weeks ago when I taught the class a little bit, I'm not going to try and find it, but in Hebrews, it talks about that if Joshua had promised them a land of rest, then the Bible account wouldn't have talked about them having to go in and do the things that they needed to do. And so God did not promise them a land of rest. He promised them the land of milk and honey, but he didn't promise them that they could just sit down and quit, as it were. And so he makes the comparison there, is that God has promised us, he's promised Christians, a land of rest, and as he encourages them not to turn away from the kingdom of God and turn back to Judaism, he says, we've been promised a land of rest. Don't be like the people of Israel who turned back from the land and had to wander in the wilderness for 40 years, even though they weren't promised a land of rest. They were promised a land of plenty, but they weren't promised a land of rest. 4, I thought it was 4. Yeah, Hebrews 4, 8. Would you read that, Chris? Right. So then in the next verse, it talks about there remaineth therefore a Sabbath rest for the people of God. So we're looking at the fact that the promises that he's making here in the book of Hebrews shows that we are promised this rest as the people of God, but Joshua was not there to give them a land of rest. So, and then in verse 11 he says, let us therefore give diligence to enter into that rest, that no man fall after the same example of disobedience as the people of Israel did. Now as we look at this, we understand. Oh, Juan. I suppose they didn't look at it that way, many of them, because even though they've been promised this land, I mean, if we look at Genesis chapter 12, is the origin of the promises. If we just go back there and look at that, we can see that it's though fairly generic, where he says that where he's talking to Abram, he says, "I'll make of thee a great nation. I'll bless thee and make thy name great, and be thou a blessing. I'll bless them that bless thee, and them that curse, I will curse thee. And in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed." So we actually have all three promises hidden in there, as it were, or in there. And then they're reiterated in different places. Jenny?
As far as I can tell, the first time it's called the land of milk and honey. Mm-hmm.
Right, unto a good land and large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the place of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. It's a better land. And as a matter of fact, when you look at the comparison between, excuse me, let's get back to the map here and come out a little bit, and you look at the comparison between Egypt and Israel, even though in this present time this shows the Nile Delta to be very green, and it certainly was at that time, but it's a very limited area. But when you look at that, it's almost, you know, it's approximately the size of the land of Israel also. But the land of Israel has more topography. It's a prettier land. I mean, I've driven from Cairo down there where it comes together all the way up to the Mediterranean Sea, and it's just not a pretty drive. I mean, you're driving through farmland and things like that, but there's not, you know, rolling hills and mountains and stuff like that. Whereas you get over here into Israel and you start driving through that, and you've got areas that are more like, when you're in the desert, they're more like our areas with mountains and things around. A pretty land, but then when you get up further into the coastal plain and such like that, it's more well watered. That'd be a proper phrase. And anyway, it's better agricultural land, and it's pretty looking land. You get over here on this side of the mountains that run sort of to about three quarters of the way over and get down, then you're in just stark desert down there. And then as you get into the Jordan River Valley, you're in areas that are very lush, but they're not very wide. Desert here, but very nice and well watered in all the other areas. So the people were going to a land where they wouldn't be slaves, even though it was a fairly nice land. But here they would own the land. And they would have their own place to raise things, so the land flowing with milk and honey. I'm not sure what importance milk and honey is, but it was a land that they could call their own that was probably equivalent to the agricultural lushness of Egypt, but it was their own land, and I think many of them found that was important to them. I think a lot of us like to say that, you know, we have our own, you know, piece of grass out here, even though we have to cut it too often. You know, people want to have something that they say that they can call their own. And but in the whole thing, they were never really promised a rest. As a matter of fact, the people were not promised a rest from the time of Genesis chapter 3 until now. I mean, it says that you'll toil and you'll sweat at the things that you're going to do, whereas when they were in the Garden of Eden, everything was perfect and the way it ought to be, and man didn't have to work that much. But as soon as he committed sin and was expelled from the Garden of Eden, God said that by the sweat of your brow you will work and such like as that. So really, it's not until we get to the book of Hebrews that we see this comparison made between what went on then and what the promise is now. You know, we're promised a land of rest, and it's not here on this earth, it's in heaven. So that's why it's important for us to understand that the passage in Hebrews is showing us that what the writer of Hebrews is trying to say is that no matter how good it was for them here and how much better it was for them to be out of bondage of Egypt, even as good as they had it here, it's not as good as the rest that we'll have in heaven when we make it there. So that's the comparison he's wanting to make. But you're right. I mean, the people were better off in the land of Canaan. And had they followed God's commands throughout and been dedicated to the job that had been assigned to them, then, as the authors here say in the chapter 19, they probably would have been a whole lot better off, or there would have been a different history. What is it? Right past the second, after the second quotation, if the Israelites had listened to the warnings and had destroyed the rest of the Canaanites, their entire remaining history might have been different. But it wasn't. I mean, obviously, we're reading a number of years after all this, and I mean, it's history. That's the way that it worked out. And so the people didn't follow God's commands, and so the promises that he made came true. And they finally came true all the way up to the Babylonian captivity when they were finally just completely taken away. And then a small remnant were allowed to return. Terry, do you remember what the magnitude of the people that returned from Babylon and ultimately from Assyrian captivity also? Seems to me it was only like in the 4,000 or 5,000 people neighborhood. It wasn't tens of thousands of people. Yeah, I think the magnitude was in the less than 5,000 range, if I recall. Right, three returns, that's right. Yeah. There are actually, as you read through the books, you find that there are actually essentially three takings away also, or the taking aways. But anyway, that this happened sort of in stages also, until finally the city of Jerusalem was just completely destroyed, and then just the poor folk were left there to take care of the lands, essentially for the same reason that God pointed out here, so that the beasts wouldn't take over. The Babylonians needed someone to, you know, handle their land for them, lest it become just a wasteland. So, okay. Yes, Randy. Deuteronomy 7, the one that... 22, yeah. That's the little by little part. What's that? What's the New American saying?
The New American saying is, the Lord your God will clear away these nations before you little by little.
Yeah. So, though God had made that promise to them, they didn't really carry through with it. Their mind was not in the work, as it were. No.
Now the Lord was with Judah, and they took possession of the hill country, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had iron chariots.
Yeah.
So the Lord just was not going to drive them all out at the same time. That's just they had iron chariots. So.
Right. And so we see once again by the time that this book of Judges comes around, you know, they've already been in the land for a while. And they just haven't taken care of things the way that they could have and should have, perhaps. So they've, in certain instances, perhaps allowed the people of the land to sort of fall back and gather their forces or rearm themselves or whatever you want to call it, and become prepared for this battle. And perhaps prepared for the battle knowing that the Israelites really weren't going to put their heart into it too much. Yes, Lynn.
Well, one of the other things that happened as time passed, the people that conquered the land, the older ones died off, and the younger ones don't seem to have been taught. And of course, they didn't experience the same things. And so it was a whole lot easier for them to kind of like put that aside and just go with the flow, as people say today.
Yes, yes, that's right. At the beginning of the book of Judges, you know, God assigns people to go up to conquer the people, but they apparently by their lack of effort in the past, just were not, you might say, blessed the way that they hoped they would be, because they hadn't made the effort at the beginning. Yes, Randy.
On the other hand.
I believe so, yeah.
And Caleb's 85 years old.
Yeah, he done good.
He grew up in giants.
Yeah.
So I guess he had the will.
Right. And then in the very next verse, and it says, and the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites that inhabited Jerusalem, but the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem unto this day. So later on, of course, and when we're talking about Jerusalem here, we're talking about what we know as the city of David, which is just the more southern part of the city of Jerusalem modern. And it's actually an area of active excavation and archaeological work right now. And then David expanded the city to the north and put the Jebusites there to task work. But as I understand it, Jerusalem, as you go back and translate the words, simply means peace of the Jebusites, or the peaceful city of the Jebusites, or something like that. But so they're the ones that used to live there, and they had a whole lot of trouble putting them out of their place. You know, talking about the iron chariots that were there, and what was it, verse 20? 19. You'll remember when the Israelites were going up to fight one of the battles, and God, it says, discomfited them, and they came to the conclusion that, well, he's a god of the plains, and we should go up and bring this battle up into the hills because our God is a god of the hills. And then they came to the conclusion after they'd been defeated somewhat up there that God was a god of the hills also. Yeah, I think it's interesting that here they couldn't drive them out because of their chariots of iron down on the plains, but they managed to get them in the hills. And then at another time, the people that they're fighting are talking about, well, God is a god of the plains, or God is a god of the hills. And, you know, if you're the children of God and you realize that there's only one true God, then that must be kind of a challenge to you to say, no, there's only one God. But really what they ended up doing was eventually, not in this case, but eventually just accepting the God of the hills and the God of the valley and all that, and just turning away from the one true God. Did you?
Well, it's just that at the end of chapter 2, the last couple of verses, God says that he's angry with people because, of course, you know, they forsaken him, and that he was going to leave those people there to test them to see whether or not they'll follow him.
Yeah, they did a fine job of that. Yeah.
Sorry?
I say they did a fine job of that, too. You know, once again, kind of like a lot of us, we start out zealous and strong and end up just sort of tapering off. Don't keep it going.
We want to live in a sin-free world, and we find out there's things that test us all the time.
Yes, there are. That's right. Yeah. As there's a lot of people that try to live in their own sin-free communities, you know, around as the world was developing, you know, and people would go off and they just make their own little community, and we're going to make this a sin-free community, and they just found out the true nature of people. It just didn't work out. So, been a lot of trying and very little success. Rather than just following after the Word of God and doing what He says. I think it was, Jesus said that many are called, but few are chosen. We don't see that of all the thousands and thousands of people that Jesus taught, that every one of them came to the knowledge of Him and turned and became later on the Christian that they ought to be. We see that a lot of the people, it says, turn back from following after Him. So, and this was a man who worked miracles, who turned out, if they had just looked at it, turned out to be the Savior of the world, and they refused to accept Him. We see the same thing today, that, you know, we look at our metropolitan area here of 300 or 400,000 in the Antelope Valley area and think, well, you know, we can still number in the less than a couple of hundreds, perhaps, the number of people that are actually Christians among those. So it's what does the song say? There's there is work to do. There's work to do. There's work on every. There's something on every hand. What? On every hand. There is much to do. There's work on every hand. All right. Wow. yeah. Down toward the bottom of page 75, it talks about that gradually all the battles ceased. And we see that God was not pleased with the people because they hadn't obeyed Him. And He told them that there would be a time that would come that He would no longer help them. And that time, of course, showed up because of their idolatry and their turning away from God and doing the things that they wanted to do instead of the things that God wanted them to do. It says in the third sentence of the paragraph just up above the bottom, it says, they would be left to prove Israel to see if they would be faithful in spite of the idolatrous worship of their surrounding neighbors, Judges 2, 20 through 23. I think, Lynn, that's what you pointed out. So it's sort of a test. It says Israel failed the test innumerable times as the years went by. So at the end of page 75, we're talking about, as he says, for the next long period of history, the Israelites lived in their tribal territories, etc., with no central government. And so as we wrap up the class here, what cycle then are we going to start getting into as we get into the book of Judges and into the lesson here starting at the book of page 75? What cycle are we looking at? Right. So we've got this continual cycle through all the judges. as a matter of fact, I've got right here, Lynn was asking me where all these came from, but these are questions that Mickey and I have in an accompanying book. But notice the number of judges. 14. I didn't remember the number. So 14 judges. And so this cycle continued out through a really long period of time. And so the people would disobey, and they'd start pleading to God, really, is what they were doing for deliverance. And then God would raise up a judge and send the judge out to take care of the bad guys. And then the people would get lax again, and they'd turn back to sin again. Randy and then Juan.
I was just going to say that the cycle is sin, judgment, repentance, salvation.
True.
And then over and over and over.
14 times.
But the interesting thing about that is still the cycle of man.
Yes, that's true. And I think Jesus is called a judge in some place in the New Testament. And he's the what? The judgment seat of Christ, yeah. Juan, you had a comment or a question? Or?
I think this is the first time I've ever seen where it shows that God allowed something to be there, knowing, trying to give us a chance to sit there and see if we can beat it. Because, I mean, I, in my younger days, and if you still hear it nowadays, is that it's always like, well, if God didn't want me to do this or have this, he wouldn't have put that there. And that's kind of crazy that you sit there and say, I'm going to leave these group of people here so you can learn this. And you guys just, and they fail miserably, but we're kind of the same way. He lets a lot of things happen, a lot of things, just to see what we're made of. But you just take it as, oh, so since it's there, it's okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that'll say that your faithfulness to God is portrayed in the amount of wealth that you have because God has blessed you with all these things. And then you look at the people that, you know, inhabit our prisons or end up, you know, being really bad people. You know, a lot of them have got a lot of money because they did the wrong things. And if we just look at the country that we live in America, the people that started it off, they appeared to be many of them, quite dedicated to God, at least on the face of things. And it used to be that they would say that America was, you know, God's country almost type thing. But I think it's been pointed out in sermons many times is that when we get comfortable, we get less active. And I think that's what happened to these folks is that they got comfortable in the way that they were. And they thought, well, you know, things are okay. You know, what, I'll get this one. You know, we don't need to do anything. God's kind of taking care of us. He's made us prosper. And therefore, we must be good. But what it says in, it's on the right-hand page and left-hand column up at the top. It says, no temptation has overtaken you such that God does not provide a way out. That's a really a way of escape, a really loose paraphrase. But if you look on the right-hand page in the left-hand column all the way at the top, you'll find it. So, yeah. So, anyway, we'll pick up where Mickey left off last time was just sort of an introduction to the history of the judges. Thank you for your comments and assistance.